Blog Talk Radio. responsible man can transcend irresponsibility, and each of us must face the areas in which we show least maturity and move toward maturity. He must face it as wisely, as rapidly as situations will permit. This means greater consideration for universal principles and greater attentiveness to these principles. It demands a reorientation in education and sociology. It demands to our attention the fact that the final survival pattern is the pattern of integrity. Any individual who compromises integrity compromises the probability of his own security. He is not injuring any other person to the degree that he is injuring himself. The constructive side of all of this also looms clearly on the horizon. Human beings do not enjoy being uncomfortable. We do not want to be permanently miserable. We wish to do whatever we please without consent consequences. As this formula is proving itself to be unreasonable, it has to be discarded. The goal of man's existence is an inner security, happiness, and enlightenment. The individual is here to grow, and if he grows gracefully, he will be happy. If he grows only through misery or course, of course, he will be unhappy and will resent the cost of his enlightenment. But in either case, he will grow in understanding. He has the right to grow with happiness, enjoying his life experiences, and he has the right to be a better person every day because he finds his greatest joy in the surpassing of self. We are surrounded with a vast body of evidence which attests to the divine plan of things. It is our privilege to be able to observe this body of natural phenomena and to realize the course we ourselves must make. We must learn to use natural law as the final criterion for value. Not even the most skillful of persons, can go against natural law for any substantial length of time. It may appear that we can break natural law temporarily, but the law which we try to break will ultimately break us. We cannot succeed in defying nature. Nature, however, offers a number of benevolent prospects. There is no reason why a human society from which a number of major defects have been removed should not enjoy far greater health, length of life, trust, and security for its citizens, and still operate with greater effectiveness, and it participates more in nature's program for health, it shall enjoy greater social health. It is not at all unreasonable to assume that with the length of time required for the individual to achieve maturity, he should not be able to continue for another 100 years. This will remain uncommon, however, as long as most of us are breaking the rules and are living in the society which itself breaks the rules. We can, however, correct this rule-breaking tendency. Greater social not at all unreasonable to assume that with the length of time required for the individual to achieve maturity, we should not be able to continue for another 100 years. This will remain uncommon, however, as long as most of us are breaking the rules and are living in a society which itself breaks the rules. We can, however, correct this rule-breaking tendency. There is no reason why anyone has to remain a neurotic forever. Neurosis may be one of the greatest causes of misery that we have in the world today, but it is not an inevitable nor a necessity. It is a mental sickness that results almost completely from man's inability to understand the laws of his own mind. Not that he does not know what these laws are, which makes him sick, but his emotions and attitudes will not permit him to transcend his own errors. One of our big problems is this necessity to avoid pain and discomfort. We enjoy a Herculean meal and then medicate ourselves to avoid the discomfort from eating too much. We do everything possible to ensure mental fatigue and anxiety and then reach into the medicine chest so we can ignore the symptoms of stress. Why do we wonder that we cannot survive successfully on food which has no nutritional value? And why must we sacrifice 50,000 Americans in automobile accidents every year, maybe many times that figure? These are not requirements of nature, and the idea that these things are inevitable because they are part of progress is just stupid. This is not inevitable, and they are not part of progress. They are the inevitable consequence of man's own stupidity and nothing else. But these things can be corrected. There is no reason why we should have the type of crime that is now besetting us. There is no reason why a university professor with a PhD should invite his student to be users of narcotics. He shares the same stupidity with his students who accept his offer. These things are unnecessary. Most of the mistakes we make are simply the result of our immaturity, selfishness, foolishness, and arrogance. And nature does not permit this to continue indefinitely. For if nature did not step in, then the purposes of nature would be damaged. Then we would be in danger of the grand frustration. Nature will keep on pounding on us until we make the necessary corrections. We are also fairly exhausted by international complications. We are tired of boundary lines. We are tired of the perversities and inconsistencies of various administrations all over the world. We are tired of nations that acquire these freedoms, their freedom, only to make their own citizens less free 6 months later. These immaturities, personal, national, and international, are not required of nature. They are not some mass of inevitables that have descended from the stars, nor are they requirements for some starry influence. They are actually the result of our own unregenerate attitudes. These unregenerate attitudes are leading us to situations which no one will enjoy. Humanity as a group will rise against these national selfish attitudes, and solutions are going to be considered from a global perspective. And the more enlightened our decisions, the more unselfish our goals, the more likely they will have enduring power. For all solutions are relative and either work with the plans of nature and endure or oppose nature and collapse. I think every one of us should allow a certain portion of his day to make peace with life. And this does not ordinarily require more than a few moments each day. We can do it in various ways, and the various meditational systems of the world might assist us. But here, technique is less important than intent. We will find that if this peacemaking does nothing else, it will begin to make life less expensive. When we make peace with life, it's entirely possible that our doctor bills will be reduced and away all that junk in the medicine cabinet. I even suspect that we will have fewer lawsuits. Those inevitable sorrows and misfortunes which arise from poor decisions will no longer plague us. Religions in the past have tried to help us make the peace as peace with nature. But unfortunately, religions are made up of people. And religion is not a sacrosanct group, but is isolated from humanity. It is conviction interpreted by and misinterpreted by millions of people. But basically, religion has given us the golden rule and the Ten Commandments. And these basics are verified every day by the conduct of men of goodwill in every land. The Ten Commandments have been more important than any scientific discovery yet made. And without the Ten Commandments, science is capable of creating monsters who turn on their creators. To have skill without having developed integrity is a fatal situation. Plato, Aristotle, Plotinus, Proclus, Ambucius, all the great Western philosophers, and Confucius, Lao Tzu, and Buddha have testified that selfishness is man's biggest problem. Perhaps Buddha was one of the most outspoken on this problem, for he was so convinced that human selfishness and human ignorance were the foundations of man's dilemma, that he strongly advocated the intelligent person to renounce the entire social and mental structure to which he belonged. And there is a slight modification of the view in the developments of Buddhism. But it is still a renunciation of worldliness, if not a renunciation of the world itself. But one important point remains constant, and that is that our own minds are the tyrants. Until we educate our own minds away from selfishness and ambition, there will be no peace in this world, no peace of mind, and no bliss in the world to come. This is very basic, and the proof of this is the fact that when we start to make these corrections, life becomes more interesting and fulfilling, for we are working with nature and not against nature. Therefore, we are accepting the responsibility of conduct. We can then realize why minds were given to us, that they might be used. We were intended to use our minds as perpetual instruments of an adolescent playtime. The mind must grow up and become the protector of the individual and not the exploiter of society. If mind stuff is properly trained, it can accomplish great things, but an undisciplined mind complicates, confuses, and causes the individual to be here, there, and everywhere. In the days that lie ahead, one of two points might be of interest. Man must basically develop a workable faith, a faith that is based not upon creedal affiliations, although this is not necessarily wrong, but a faith that is operative. The individual must gradually come to know that there are powers and forces in nature that are dedicated to good. If we do not assume them to be good, we still have to assume them to be natural. And whether we accept or dislike natural law, we will obey it or suffer. Experience proves to us that natural law is right. When we cooperate with it, we perceive its intelligent workings, every part of existence. So we must have a faith. We have to believe sincerely, and there is a purpose. We may not know what that purpose is, but we have to believe in it. And we have to believe that this purpose requires us to be honest. If we are honest, this purpose will protect us. And if we are not honest, this purpose will turn against us and punish us. This much religion we have to have. We have to have a faith in the integrity of the total existence of which we belong. And we have to realize that this total existence demands that we keep that faith every day, all the time. If we do not keep this faith, the future of our way of life is assured. If we do not keep it, the future lies in an uncertain bog of conflict and confusion. have a faith. A faith which makes us stronger to do what we know we must do. We can then learn its intellectual justification. But faith nearly always has to have an emotional impact if it is to be effective. A mental systemization does not have sufficient force behind it to bring change in conduct. The principal support of faith in man, however, is experience. Lord Bacon declared that there were three instruments in the Instauratio Magna for the establishment of knowledge. One is tradition, faith supported by the evidence of other ancestors in the past. In this way, faith is strengthened by history, a total adventure of man's existence. The second instrument of knowledge is observation, by which we look upon us for the immutable workings of universal principles. If we want to look for these principles, we must find them everywhere. If we choose to ignore them, we can, but to our own delay. But whether we find them or whether we ignore them, they operate on us. And the fact that we try to ignore them has no effect upon their immediate reaction on our lives. The third instrument is experimentation, in which we can set up various processes by which immutable operations of natural law can be verified and justified. These experiments can fulfill the scientific requirements of repeatability and can be performed again and again to demonstrate the absolute consistency of universal processes. In a laboratory, we find that cause and direct and effect inevitably follow each other. So, in various ways, within our means, it is possible to become increasingly aware of nature's purpose and nature's omniscience. We can also gradually become more respectful of nature, realizing that this vast environment in which we exist is worthy of veneration. It is worthy of obedience and recognition of being the natural leader of all that lives. We are all citizens of this natural commonwealth. We do not make its laws, but we must obey them. For we can trust these laws not because they originate in human fallibility, but because they would exist independent of man's recognition. They are supported by the infinite purpose of life, purposes which are not easily disproven, even when we cannot fully understand them. So natural law becomes the overlord. It is above everything. It is above nations and the United Nations. All things men build must be built in harmony with these things, or they will not live. And nothing which is built in harmony with the universal law will actually perish. So instead of believing ourselves to be castaways on a little ball in space, which we call the Earth, we are actually involved in, surrounded about, and permeated throughout our entire structure with a network of immutable principles. Law is the intelligence in the body of space. It sees to it that the will of God is executed, and it is as near to us as our breath. It is something which governs every part of our lives. There is not a function in our body which does not operate under law. There is not a mood or an emotion which does not produce its inevitable consequences. And every work of art attests to the intelligence which is impregnated in matter. Machines are men's efforts to duplicate and amplify forces already present in nature. To the sensitive man, there is an overwhelming proof of universal law, and this proof is the answer to the lawlessness of men. Someday, we shall all face this fact with acceptance. We do not have the right to make rules that are contrary to the purposes of life. Selfishness, indifference, and cruelty can result only in the disintegration of society. Having one of this quiet thoughtfulness, having come to this quiet thoughtfulness, the private citizen can make his own personal pact with universal purpose. He can try to live on all the levels of his own experience in harmony with life. And harmony is an extremely important concept. Harmony means a sympathetic vibration to nature. It is working with the plan of things. Harmony means proportion and equilibrium. From observation, we learn that the individual who is inharmonious with himself is more apt to have ulcers. The individual who is angry damages his own health and how often we see excessive ambition end with an early death. Every time we permit unreasonable conduct to arise in ourselves, we damage our bodies, our minds, and our emotions, and our heads over ourselves into and head ourselves into tragedy and misery. Just as surely as this is true in the individual, so it is true in the social commonwealth. Unless society stops breaking the laws of peace and order, it will continue to bring upon itself all the various social ailments for which society can suffer. And it is perfectly possible for a nation to have a coronary. It is perfectly possible for a vast economic project to develop ulcers. And it is quite possible for an entire educational system to become neurotic. Wherever rules are broken, trouble is never far. Let our faith be built not on theological premises, but as the insights gained from right conduct and obedience to divine will. We call it divine will because it is infinitely superior to anything we know. Not to respect it, not to venerate it, and not to maturely regard it is foolish. The regard of indifference in these matters is simply sickness. We would probably be more careful if we could somehow experience in advance some of the consequences of our mistakes. If a person in his 20s could know the consequences of his actions upon his body, which he will feel in his 50s, he probably would act with more intelligent use of energy. If a person would experience the pain of a heart attack every time he enjoyed a nice outburst of righteous indignation, few of us would so indulge ourselves. And also, if we could see, even for a short period of time, all the consequences of our dishonesty in 50 or 60 years, we would all probably be aggressively honest. We do not recognize the certainty of our moral conduct, and by the time these things return to us, we can convince ourselves that we have been singled out for misfortune, for some caprice of God, for certainly we are not in any way responsible for the events that befall us. A society does what it has always done. It buries its disasters. The victims complain only for a little while, and then there is silence. The ounce of prevention may be a little late, but the pound of cure still works. And it is time to start working with it. And I'm just going to pause there for a second because this is so real, one of my favorite essays that I've ever read was the essay on compensation by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And Emerson stated that for every yin, there's a yang, basically. You know, for every right, there's a wrong. For every, but everything has its due, and it may come to you later, it may come to you sooner. But he said that putting God as your exchequer, making God your accountant, okay. Is the greatest way. And by doing so, all that you do will sooner or later that we are living within a structure of law. Let it be every request as good or better as any form of law that man can imagine. It is not necessary in order to keep natural law to live below the level of man-made laws. Socrates pointed this out very clearly and was unwilling to compromise either. It is not necessary for a person who is better than his society to break the rules of his society. He can live above them, but there is no reason why he should live below them. Thus it happens that integrity shall mean the most to us. The individual who is never burglarized in all of his ancient past does not have the same likelihood of being burglarized as one who has had this conduct in his more recent past. And I sometimes think that we put so many locks upon our doors because we are uncertain that we deserve the things we have, but are unwilling to give them to someone else. The laws of the universe do not have to be broken just because we do not see the justice of things in all instances. If we do not break the rules of natural law, we seldom come into conflict with man-made laws. And as Socrates pointed out, if there is a conflict, then we must do what is essential to the integrity of ourselves and others. Socrates could have saved his life if he had been willing to be part of the face-saving device. His guardians were quite willing to allow him an escape if he would just leave the country and pay a small fine. He refused, and he said that if he were to pay a fine, he would be admitting a guilt which he did not have. And secondly, if he were allowed to escape, he would be breaking the laws of Athens. And while many would say that he was justified by breaking the law, still, he would be setting an example of law-breaking, which would cause others to say, wise men break laws, therefore why should I? And Socrates would not allow himself to be an example of lawlessness. We remember the story of Jesus and the coin with Caesar's face. He said, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto God that which is God's. So no one is going to solve this problem by breaking man-made law. Abraham Lincoln knew this, and so did Martin Buber. We can live a life superior to the life required by our society. We can be more honest than the law demands, because honesty may be a law, but integrity is the attainment within ourselves. And it is integrity which is going to lead us into the commonwealth of the future. We are going to gradually recognize that laws can only inhibit crime, but wisdom can transcend the instinct to crime or violence. Without this moral cultivation, laws do not work, and we are reaching the point where man must rule from within himself. We must simply maintain character, a character which cannot be corrupted. This was the point taken by Confucius, who pointed out that the only human superiority that exists is that which does not permit the individual to corrupt himself or others. It will not allow the individual to live below the level of his own attainment. This new standard of integrity has to become our guiding star into tomorrow's of international relations. Nothing else will work. Everything else is fact as failed. And every patch that is put on which compromises principles will fall off. We are reaching the desperate condition in which only our integrities can solve our problems. And I have to stop here for 1 second because this is exactly what the Mayan calendar has stated. This is exactly what the Mayan prophecies of 2012 have stated. And that is that our own integrity, our own intuition, and our own integrity is what will carry us forward, all right? It will carry us through. And that the new society that is coming, that the society of Aquarius, the new Aquarian age, okay, is one of integrity, one of righteousness, one of pure brotherhood and compassion. And this is what's coming. This is what we are evolving into. And if I can bring up my friend George Dixon, this is what he has been advocating, and this is what he was talking about, is that the new age, the new age which is dawning in December, on December 21st, actually, or I should say December 22nd, ends on the old age ends on December 21st. The new age begins on December 22nd, 2012. And this age is one of brotherly love, one of human compassion for another, one of sharing wealth, sharing world benefits and brotherhood. And this is what is supposed to happen, the age of Aquarius that is dawning in 2012, December 22nd. And the great celebration of the Mayans will take place on the 22nd of December because it's bringing in the new age and the ascension and the enlightenment of mankind. And this is a wonderful thing. And without mention of the Mayans, Manly P. Hall, in his genius, had predicted this. He had seen this. He knew this was coming. This had to come in order for man to survive, right? And for that reason, I'll continue with this essay tonight. This new standard of integrity has to become our guiding star into the tomorrows of international relationships. Nothing else will work, and everything else, in fact, has failed. And every patch that is put on which compromises principles will fall off. We are reaching the desperate condition in which only our own integrities can solve our problems. If we look forward 50 or more or 100 years into the future, we can see that the momentum of events is moving and rapidly, that man must rise against his own mistakes. He must face his own corruptions and his own weaknesses. Let us also bear in mind something which most people tend to forget, and that is that so-called revolutions or reformations do not necessarily start at the bottom. Practically every social revolution we have ever had accomplished anything has started at the top. It is not the underprivileged who lead the successful revolution. It is the person of insight who has already realized the truth of the matter and has the mind, the understanding, and the integrity to see both a problem and something of its solution. Such individuals have been, for the most part, the guiding spirit behind every major change in human society. Change has actually been achieved by the thoughtful, and the more thoughtful people are, the more painless can necessary changes be made. If, however, changes are attempted simply on the basis of brute force and awkwardness, they will merely transform us into another dilemma. Therefore, each person who becomes more thoughtful, more honorable, and more sincere becomes a potential factor in the progress of man at this critical period of our experience. We may wake up one of these days and find that our industrial empire has collapsed. It is likely that it will, for we do not have endless fact, we will have all kinds of difficulty unless we turn back some of our urbanization into land. For the cultivation of necessary food. This idea that we will be able to create synthetic foods is a very dangerous one, and as much as we have never yet created anything. We can reform things, more existing elements, and recombine them in new ways, but I suspect that there is a vitality factor in food which will make synthetics less than satisfactory. Vitamins, and then we're talking about genetically modified foods already. I mean, we found that they are totally deplete in nutrition. Vitamins are best obtained naturally through wholesome food. Synthetics are of yet, but have not been able to duplicate every factor present in their natural equivalent. And our synthetics are only poor copies of the dominant elements. Synthetic food is not likely to be any more successful than synthetic medications are completely satisfactory. Something is missing, something which is present in the natural product. Man not only is unable to copy it, he does not know what it is he is looking for. So this idea that we will be able to float off into a higher realm from the gifts of science should be considered with caution. We might be floating off, never to come back, and this is probably not the end we want. There are other basic food problems that are for us. Providing good nutrition is becoming increasingly more difficult. I am reminded of this, what visitors used to say about California flowers. They look good, but they have no fragrance. Our modern fruit looks good, but so often is tasteless. This sort of thing has stimulated quite an interest in organic farming. And little by little, we need to re-examine this mass cultivation, which requires artificial fertilizers and insecticides. We need to find that level at which nature can be the great provider, and we need to get rid of those things which are exhausting natural resources faster than they can be replenished. Ultimately, we probably will be forced to live much more simply than we do presently. But this is not the disaster we are inclined to imagine. Simply, community living is not less desirable. It is a sign of greater maturity. We must even have time to escape from the pressures of an artificial system, and might have time to appreciate something of the quality of a home, something of the quality of a family, and something approaching self-culture and education. Perhaps even a pride shall return in doing something ourselves. Throughout the world, there are traces of this domestic revolt. In the old days, a son was first apprenticed to his father. After he was able to ensure his own economic survival, he was allowed the luxury of originality. And one of the marvelous benefits of such a system was the fact that father and son grew up together. Most of the members of a family worked together, and this team effort was the bond which brought an inner security to their lives. The family unit demanded an integrity which is now almost completely lost. We really have to get back to some of these integrities, or in our case, move forward to them. And the idea that we can or should break up all human relationships and solve our problems by denying their existence will not work. For a while, it looked as if China was moving in that direction even faster than we were. But communalism isn't the first ideology. It is imported into the country. Eventually, transmuted to things forever Chinese, and the destruction of human relationships. However noble be the purpose, it is contrary to natural law. Natural law makes a simple statement. It is essential to human survival that children be properly disciplined, properly enlightened, and be given proper example in their own homes. The first 10 years of life are terribly important, and a good home life is the best insurance against the collapse of a civilization. And Confucius pointed this out too, 2,500 years ago. A social system should advance the reason why we are here, and we are here to advance the growth of our internal consciousness. We are here to finally to learn to love the beautiful and serve the good, and we are here to understand each other and to gain the expertise of eternity. We are here to gain the experiences of kindness and cooperation. We are here to permit the natural development of our constructive feelings. Dollars and cents are poor measurements of development. We are here to learn how to give an honest day's work for an honest day's wage. We are here to learn care, exactitude, patience, generosity. We are here to give rather than take. And as an artisan, we learn to produce a product which gives benefit to the customer rather than the creator. For no matter how clever we are, we cannot do that which is wrong and have it come out right. So the future of the world demands an increasing sensitivity to honesty, integrity, and value. It requires that we be increasingly thoughtful, and also, as it happens, nature does not really want us to become so absolutely fascinated with our material situation that we can think of nothing else, prepare for nothing else, or expect nothing else than that which we are currently involved. Nature's purpose is to use this world as a place of learning and a place of training. This is a training area for the development of character. For man cannot take with him anything which he has made, but he can take the skill to make things. He cannot possibly move into another world, the career which he has built here. But his career, he is correct. But if his career here is correct, he departs in this world a better, more enlightened, more noble, and more refined creature than when he arrived. And therefore, nature's interest is not to produce human beings who amount to something. Nature is not of that mind that an individual should spend almost his entire lifetime merely in the process of surviving and nothing else. Nor was he intended to develop enormous career pressures which forced him to give up everything of his personal life in order to become the president of a corporation. These are not nature's plans, and a person who so lives frustrates nature's purposes. Nature penalizes not because she is cruel, but because she has no other uses for man. She has other uses for man. Such individuals not only fight their competitors, they fight against their own bodies when they insist on success. The time for this type of battle is very close to ending, and every day we observe men who have lost faith in the omnipotence of a vast industrial empire. And this faith becomes more and more disillusioned, and we will have more and more persons realizing that we are here to learn something about living itself, to learn and understand values in part of nature's purpose for us. For nature wants us to be not only citizens of the world, but of the cosmos. And universal law is the law that must be first obeyed. To what heights we build with universal law is up to us, but the moment we go contrary to it, we sign our own warrant for misery. a great number of things and take great joy in doing them. Actually, as a cooperator, we can have more freedom than we enjoy now, because now we have enslaved to each other's mistakes. Like an honest citizen of a community, we will be able to do more things because our credit with life will be good. The honest citizen of the world keeps the rules and does not resent reasonable regulation of conduct. We can have a great deal of individuality, but it should never go contrary to principles. Let us be mindful that we are not permanent residents of this world, but appreciative guests of a kind nature. We should take it for granted that we must now begin to build a sense of respect for that to which our allegiance is primarily due, and that support is required to God. Our allegiance is to the great plan which makes our very essence possible. We did not create ourselves. We were created by a plan so wise that cannot even begin to understand it. And the plan which created us set up the rules for our conduct, and we must learn those rules and obey them. Many of nature's rules we already know, but we seldom apply them or keep them. Let us come closer to the values which we know to be right. If we do this, I do not think we will have too much occasion for pessimism. There are already indications of strong idealism at hand, and every day, amidst news of disasters and the news of daily hijacking, is some little beam that reveals the growing good of man, and there is no better place to work with this idealism than in ourselves. Instead of sitting back hoping that everything essential will be accomplished out there, we would be better to start right here. There are little things we can all do to make sure that we are contributing to the better part of things, and we can refrain our supporting the worst parts of ourselves. We can curb our own excesses and be mindful of our own extravagances. And we can curtail our own ambitions and do everything possible to live compatibly with our families and our environments. And if we take the world as it is today and place it in a utopian civilization, utopia would end on the spot. We are not capable or ready for utopia. And we are not capable or ready for peace. No matter what situation we are in, we will find some reason to complain. And regardless of the good that comes into our lives, we find some reason to nag and complain that the good isn't good enough. Our own self-centeredness frustrates every noble thing that enters our life. If we want to live in a better world, make ourselves capable of living in a superior world, for in this better world, a great many shortcuts and a great many selfish policies are going to have to end. If we insist on perpetrating them, we will destroy the new world as we have destroyed an old one. We have to change. It is not society that must. Our arguing family living in a farmhouse will still argue if they are put in a palace. You can take the selfish man out of a business dilemma which has gone wrong, rearrange the affairs, straighten out his finances, and in a short time, his selfishness will work to wreck the new arrangement, for the wrecking factor is in him. We all have a tendency to wreck everything we touch when we dominate it with selfishness, avarice, ambition, and ignorance. We have got to get rid of these qualities before we can hope to take on problems of the world. We have to really want to see our people happy before we can help them. Usually our attempts to help others are interferences and are accepted as such. We have to learn to be as patient with the faults of others as they must be with our faults. We must determine in our consciousness to find the good in things, or else the bad which we continually find will make us sick. We really should change to become more kindly, more integrated, and more doubts and prejudices, and we have to stop nagging, belittling, and this endless criticism. What is most difficult, we have to change ourselves from this, is the only basis upon which a utopia can be built. We must someday realize that there is to find the dignity, that there is more joy in good labor than there is in bad leisure. We are going to have to find the dignity of a good day's work well done, and we are going to have to stop living off our society and live for the advancement of our common good. Until these changes come, we cannot face anything but revolution and trouble. So if we really want these problems solved within the next 25 years, and solved constructively, we will have to work as ourselves. If several thousand persons could simultaneously wake up to this realization, they could form a nucleus of brotherhood and social momentum which could not be easily stopped, and it is just as possible to create a positive momentum as a negative one. Our problems today are not due to the fact that everyone is wrong. Most of the bad news that we hear comes from a comparatively narrow stratum of the dissatisfaction and ill will. While most persons are a little selfish and uncertain in their dispositions, there's only a comparatively few individuals who are aggressively hostile and antisocial. Most people want to do the right thing and want to do a good job. Actually are accomplishing just this than we have any idea. But the 1 or 2% which is dedicated to violence can seemingly overwhelm the remaining nonviolent masses. We hear in the news only of the misfits and neurotics and not of the peaceful and the beautiful. By the same principle, if 2% of the population would attain an internal integration and set the right example, a new direction might be able to be given to the future. If a handful of dissatisfied individuals can disturb us profoundly, and an equal handful of men of goodwill, dedicated to the implication of useful purposes, can give us a great new confidence in life, there is no question about it. We have to begin to produce individuals, those of towardness, as we were going forward into the greater life. They are symbolized by an emblem which represented the union of God, nature, and man, an ultimate teamwork. The 47th purpose of Euclid symbolizes this teamwork of three powers working together. And if we work together, we can accomplish the goals for which we were intended. If we do not work together, or if one force refuses to do this part, then the entire venture, entire spiritual implantation system fails, if only temporarily, not permanently, for eventually nature will win, and there is nothing anyone can do to prevent it. So why is it necessary for us to suffer acutely in this process? Nature is honest, and it is time we become honest with nature. And that's the end our program is almost ended here. It has ended. And I'm going to continue because I've got one more page to read for this essay. I therefore want to remind you of an idea for a utopian dream that is different from anything we have had in the past. In the past, utopias have been highly regimented, theologically oriented societies, at least in the mental constructs of their creators. Utopians are individuals forced into a type of common socialism. Each individual had to sacrifice everything he had to become a total social conformist. And most importantly, what was to conform to was either early or medieval Catholic or Protestant concepts of great restriction. There was actually very little vision of a greater life present. But there was, however, a great emphasis upon the solid integrities of relationships. The new utopia is a world of freedom in which the individual has the right to do as he pleases because he pleases to do that which is right. It is the individual growing into self-responsibility for conduct. Not that he is growing to have obvious laws fighting with him all the time or forcing him into lying, for this forcing is wrong too. We must grow by our own choice and not through coercion. All growth and progress comes from a revolutionary motion within the individual. Only when a person wakes up from his own ignorance can he become an enlightened and responsible citizen. Until then, you only have an arguing dissenter whose main interest is to overthrow the system which he considers to be dictatorial, that is right to be wrong. Actually, we only have the right to be right, and this is what we should be defending. We all have the right to live creative, constructive, and purposeful lives within the areas of our own attainments. We have the right to be more generous, more kind, more willing to help others than any law demands. And we have the right to be, as far as possible, cooperators of purpose. Our allegiance belongs to the divine plan itself, which we should serve joyfully, not with resentment. And because other people do not see this, is of no essential concern to us. We have the right to be right, and it is quite probable that as we become right and our lives correspondingly improve, others who have hesitated will begin to see it our way. And within the next 50 years, certainly, we are going to have a major change in all world policies, a settling down of things, a gradual realization that ruthless ambitions lead to extinction. We are going to discover that we can aspire without injuring anyone. We can have all the beauty and truth we need without making others poorer. We must end this gathering of ourselves, of all the world's resources, only to sell them back to the people for whom we stole them. Everything which is priceless to our needs is available. Wisdom is available, and a wise man does not prevent another man from becoming wise. Truth, beauty, love, friendship, these are universal values, and there will never be a shortage of them. The only reason why they do not express themselves more is because man locks them out of his heart and forbids them to find expression in himself. We have a lot of work to do, but it can be done. And if this is done, we will know that we are passing into a new reformation, a reformation with universal consent. It will be the mature result of man's awakening. As soon as he knows that he must keep the rules thoroughly, he takes that step that will extricate him from problems. We have fought crime, poverty, and disease for thousands of years, but the reason why we have had this long struggle is because man has never realized that the great good things he wants must be earned by the development of his own character. Once he learns this, he is on his own way to the golden commonwealth he seeks. It will come, but it will only come when it comes first in each of us as a consciousness, highly purposed effort to keep the larger rules. As we keep universal law, the law will sustain us. As citizens of a cosmic commonwealth, we can accept the leadership of a divine will. It is an enormous privilege and a tremendous challenge. And that is the end of that essay. The name of it again was the Citizens of a Cosmic Commonwealth, Accepting the Leadership of the Divine Will, and by Manly P. Hall. And I hope you enjoyed that. At least got something out of it. I didn't have a chance to really comment on it because the essay was quite lengthy, but it was important to note that only through our personal from our desires